the CCP and the PRC in general is not necessarily a unitary actor. You know, there are many competing interests. Xi Jinping doesn't always know everything the PLA is doing. They are not always doing exactly what he expects them to be doing.
Hello, and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I'm Chris Park from Johns Hopkins SAIS, and I'm joined by my friend Julia An. An alleged Chinese spy balloon entered U.S. airspace on January 28th and flew over the continental United States until it was shot down off of the coast of South Carolina on February 4th. Since then, the U.S. government has detected and shot down three more high-altitude objects, these times over northern Alaska, Yukon, and Lake Huron. In this episode, Blake Herzinger joins us to discuss the Chinese spy balloon and the Biden administration's responses. As a disclaimer to our listeners, we recorded this episode on February 13th, so the discussion may not include the latest publicly available information.
Blake Herzinger is a non-resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in Indo-Pacific defense policy and U.S. security cooperation in Asia. Having spent more than a decade as an intelligence officer with the U.S. Navy, Herzinger specifically focuses on Indo-Pacific security assistance, maritime security, and sea power. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Well, Blake, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
You bet. Thanks for having me, Chris and Julie. I appreciate it.
We're having this conversation a few days after the United States shot down an alleged Chinese spy balloon. And as the Biden administration continued to share news about unidentified objects flying over U.S. airspace, just to get our conversation started today, what are spy balloons? How high do they travel? How far can they travel? And are they maneuverable, like we imagine what airplanes, for example, might be able to do?
Sure. So these balloons, you know, they're not the type of Mylar party balloon that you might expect, or even a weather balloon. The one that was shot down first was actually probably about 200 feet tall. So, you know, very, very large balloons we're talking about. Airships might be more apt. These things can fly up into the stratosphere, 90, 100,000 feet. I believe the object that was shot down, first balloon, our first contact, was at about 65,000 feet when they shot it down, which was, you know, still high, but the fact that it was visible to the naked eye from the ground just tells you about the scale that you're dealing with. Now, in terms of how far they can go, I mean, you're looking at something launched from probably central China that is traveling over the continental United States and into the Atlantic without losing altitude. So, these things are traveling for weeks at very, very high altitudes. And it's kind of like a ship, right? So it's traveling all the time. So it's not making incredible speeds, but it is traveling 24 hours a day. So, you know, in the space of 4 days, we went from this object over Montana to it crossing into over the Atlantic. So that's one advantage is, you know, they're just always moving unless you decide to loiter, which gets to your last question on maneuverability. So these things are not agile by any means, but they do have the ability to loiter in certain areas. Now, whether that is a propulsion system or some other kind of cutting edge research that appears to be being done on balloon propulsion is algorithms measuring and tracking winds, wind speeds, traditional patterns, and then utilizing that algorithm to direct the balloon into favorable wind currents to take it, where you want it to go.
Yeah. And speaking of the first balloon, the one that was shot down earlier this month on February 4th, with the amount of news that was being broadcasted, can you give our listeners first an idea of what has Biden done since the news has broke, and how do you assess his response?
Absolutely. So they responded pretty firmly once this was in the public eye. You know, they were clearly aware of it. Biden was made aware of it several days before the shootdown. The military and NORAD were aware of it before that, and then, you know, pretty much immediately gave the permission and the all clear to shoot it down once it was safe for Americans, which I appreciate. And then after that, responded quite firmly to the PRC, you know, called this a very blatant violation of American sovereignty, which it was. kept Secretary of State Blinken's trip from going forward. So he did not travel to meet his counterpart Chen Gang or to see Xi Jinping in Beijing. And then in the last few days, they have sanctioned six entities that appear to be linked in some way or another to the PLA's balloon surveillance program. So fairly robust. And then obviously you've seen three subsequent shootdowns of other objects, which apparently were not the same scale, but, you know, unidentified objects in our stratosphere, which probably means that we're looking for the right things now and kind of learning what to look for. So I think, you know, I've got to give the Biden administration pretty high marks for this. I think they acted responsibly with regard to the safety of Americans. They acted firmly with regard to the security of the nation, and they sent a very clear message to Beijing that, you know, toying around with our sovereignty is not something that will be tolerated by this administration.
I did want to bring up one point that's been brought up already by U.S. lawmakers and now echoed amongst the American people, which is the fact that the balloon was first spotted off the coast of the Aleutian Islands. And, you know, it flew over several sensitive military sites after entering the continental U.S. Could you kind of explain why not shoot it down above the Aleutian Islands or even in sparsely populated areas while it was within the continental U.S., as some lawmakers and now citizens suggest could have been done?
So there's a few elements to that question. Now, I guess one of the first, so as a former intelligence professional, you've got to appreciate the opportunity to observe an adversary's intelligence collection platform that has drifted into your hands. You know, they had plenty of opportunity, which they took based on open source reporting, to flying the U-2 Dragon Lady over the balloon to watch what it was doing, sense for any emissions, you know, flew jets around it, getting eyes on it, getting lots of imagery of the thing, seeing what it's up to, seeing it, how it behaves, seeing how it's propelled, and kind of watching its capabilities. There were also some hints that they took active measures to keep it from collecting, whether that means some kind of jamming or just means they were very protective of what it could see. So externally, it looks like they took the precautions that I would expect and then exploited the opportunity to get a look at a adversary capability. Now, in terms of shooting it down over the Aleutian Islands, I think you could ask any cutterman in the Coast Guard about the waters around the Aleutians. That is not hospitable water space. Shooting it down over the Aleutians, you're talking about very, very cold water, so you can't put divers in to get it out. You're talking about an area that might be pretty tough for small boats to get around in there. It's February, not a great place to be. And then when you say sparsely populated, I'm from a very rural area. My family lives in a rural part of the Pacific Northwest or Mountain West, however you categorize it. And, you know, I actually take pretty personal exception to the idea from a lot of Americans that it was totally acceptable to shoot this down over sparsely populated parts of the country. There are still people that live out there. And I think it was appropriate risk management. You know, the risk to Americans was not zero. This was not an emergency. It was not a national security crisis. This was not carrying, you know, an atom bomb. They waited until the risk could be minimized to the very lowest degree possible, which was over the open ocean in the Atlantic, where they could issue legal notices to mariners and to aviators to stay out of that area. And then they put the balloon in the water and then they picked up the pieces. You know, dropping it into the mountains, you know, you're going to get a lot more from this thing dropping it into the water than you would have dropping it on top of a frozen mountain in February. You know, so I don't have a lot of time for the we should have dropped it where not many people live, because if it was my parents that got crushed by, you know, 3 bus length payload, I'd be pretty upset.
Right. And speaking of the information that we're gathering from it, I know U.S. officials have recently revealed that, you know, the balloon has appeared capable of conducting signals intelligence collection operations. What exactly does that mean?
So signals intelligence can take a lot of different forms, but effectively that means that it was capable of soaking up emissions, whether that's from telephone handsets, radio waves, or something that is emitting on the electronic spectrum. So effectively signals is soaking up that signal and then transmitting it back to a base station somewhere.
As you mentioned, the spy balloon news came just before Secretary of State Antony Blinken was set to leave for Beijing. And as you said, the Secretary of State ultimately postponed this trip after the news broke. Could you potentially speculate on China's calculations behind sending the balloon at the seemingly important moment in bilateral relations?
Sure. This is a great question. And I think you're very right to use the word speculate, because in many ways, the CCP is a black box. We do not know what the decision-making process was. We don't even know who was involved in the decision. But I still believe that this was a meeting that Chenggang and Xi Jinping wanted. They wanted this meeting to go forward, which does beg the question, then why go, you know, send a surveillance balloon over the United States? So there are a few possibilities. One was that they did know and that they were collaborating with the PLA on this type of thing, or that the PLA had brought the mission to them and had it, you know, signed off effectively, and that they were aware, and maybe they hoped it wouldn't get noticed. But I think what is maybe more likely, and this may surprise some of your listeners, but you know, the CCP and the PRC in general is not necessarily a unitary actor. You know, there are many competing interests. Xi Jinping doesn't always know everything the PLA is doing. They are not always doing exactly what he expects them to be doing. We've seen that before. When the People's Liberation Army Navy picked up a U.S. sail drone in the West Philippine Sea, you know, that was probably something that embarrassed Xi Jinping, and they gave it back pretty quickly. There have been actions on the China-Indian border that almost certainly were PLA-driven as opposed to driven from the top of the Central Military Commission, where Xi Jinping sits. So assuming that these actors are always hand in glove is a mistake. So I think it's very possible that the PLA was engaging in operations that either hadn't been appropriately de-risked, or maybe had been briefed to Xi Jinping, but maybe they were missing some key details, maybe when they were going to do it or if it was going to be observable. So I think it speaks more to a lack of coordination and a lack of effective decision-making in Beijing.
So if we consider that perhaps, you know, the incident was, you know, number one, a result of, you know, poor decision-making process where, you know, the top leaders were not necessarily aware of what was happening. But at the same time, number two, that Xi Jinping wanted to meet with Secretary of State Blinken. And I'd imagine for a variety of good reasons that, you know, they're, you know, escalating tensions around Taiwan that two countries must manage. And obviously he's voiced support for bilateral management of disagreements on a variety of issues. So has China been, you know, consistently apologetic about the incident? As I understand it, initially apologized once the news broke and explained it as some sort of weather balloon. But I'm wondering if China has consistently apologized in response in an attempt to, you know, steer the relationship to, you know, more stable ground and to a more right direction before the news of the balloon broke.
So there was a short period at the beginning where Beijing was maybe atypically apologetic, saying that they regretted that the balloon had traveled where it did, that it was due to force majeure, you know, circumstances outside their control, that this was a device that they did not intend to send over the United States. But they also lied about the nature of the balloon, which poses a problem. And then as soon as the shootdown occurred, you know, the rhetoric hardened again. It was slamming Washington for using force against this, you know, instrument of mostly civilian application that was affected by force majeure. Now, and then it was, you know, Washington is in hysterics over this incident, which is not a big deal. Never really reconciling the fact that they had violated U.S. sovereignty. And if it was an out-of-control weather balloon, Beijing had every opportunity from the beginning to tell the United States as opposed to be discovered, which leads, you know, one to believe that they probably did have a nefarious purpose with the balloon, or they were just hoping that it wouldn't go noticed. Now, obviously it had. It was spotted. It was leaked to the press. The government did respond, and the U.S. government had to respond forcefully to that because U.S. sovereignty is a big deal. And Biden is responsible, you know, to the American people and to a very hawkish Congress, which, you know, is going to demand action on something like that.
What lessons do you think China took away from the whole incident?
Well, I would hope that the signal that the United States took this very seriously was communicated. But in terms of, you know, are they going to stop things like this? I would assume they'll find better ways to do it. Maybe less observable ones. They might not fly them directly over the United States again. It's extraordinarily provocative. It's illegal. It's any number of wrong things. But, you know, is this a chastened Beijing? I certainly wouldn't characterize it that way.
And Blake, we've talked already a little bit about measures that were taken while the balloon was still up to observe and monitor. Now that the United States was able to recover the balloon after shooting it down, what do you suspect we can find out from the wreckage?
Well, so there's a few parts to that question, and thanks for asking it, Julia. But, you know, they'll look at the largest pieces they can get, right? What kind of antenna have come off this thing to see kind of what its capabilities were. They'll see if it has any data recorded on board. They'll see what kind of systems and what kind of propulsion it had. Did it have a locating beacon, which would have told us the Chinese knew where it was the whole time and could have let us know? That would be a relatively low power draw. And the thing looked like it had a pretty enormous solar array for that payload. So it would be reasonable that they would know where it was. And then down to the more granular, you know, obviously this thing has fallen from 60,000 feet, so it's probably in quite a few pieces. But down to looking into where the parts came from, you know, what supply chain produced the semiconductors that went into this thing, what companies built the components, and those things will feed, you know, likely future export control measures.
And I know a lot of people expressed surprise on the news that, you know, a balloon was being used as opposed to other kinds of technology that might be a little more advanced, like satellites. So I wondered, what did we know about Chinese surveillance balloons and their program before the incident in early February? And have we found out more information since?
Well, so it's an interesting capability, and certainly one that goes back, you know, over 100 years, observation balloons being used in the Civil War, in the First World War, Second World War, that kind of thing. But the use of these high altitude balloons is a capability that a number of countries are working on, including several companies in the United States that have got Department of Defense contracts to work on this type of technology. Australia has also been exploring similar balloon technology. And the advantage that these can give over a satellite, there's a number. You know, you don't have to launch it into space on a rocket. If you are looking for something that can loiter, in terms of a satellite, you'd have to have something that's in geosynchronous orbit. Otherwise, you're getting a pass every so often when the satellite flies by. And there's only a certain part of space, you know, a certain distance out from the atmosphere where you can park a geosynchronously orbiting satellite. So a balloon is a cheap option. It's lower observable. Obviously you're not putting it into space on a rocket. If you lose it, it's not that big a deal. Now, it does mean you're probably not going to put your most precious sensors on it, especially in peacetime, because if it crashes or is shot down, like happened to this one, your adversary is going to have access to whatever you put on it. So you have to think about that. But there's a lot of interesting capabilities that balloons can give, especially when they're married up with modern technological solutions.
And the Pentagon now assesses, since the incident, that China has sent balloons over the continental U.S. at least four times over the last 6 years that went previously undetected. A lot of our citizens and listeners probably think that U.S. airspace is tightly monitored, and with good reason. So how did previous balloons go unnoticed, and how are we finding out about past incursions now?
Well, so I don't know if they, unless you saw a different report than I did, I think this was the only one that traveled exactly kind of the way this did, with the similar loitering pattern. But having them over the continental United States, you know, it doesn't mean it traversed the whole country coast to coast. Now, you know, obviously every city doesn't have a, you know, a radar station in it. The U.S. does have very powerful surveillance radars, but a balloon, you know, another advantage to this balloon, it's a low radar cross section. It's not metal. You know, it's not an aircraft. It's not moving fast. It's not traveling like something that we'd usually be looking for. So in the last few days, us finding all these unidentified objects in our airspace is probably the result of these radars kind of being tuned in to watch things that are moving like a balloon. You know, does this, because usually that's not something we look for, right? Because it wasn't really a target that we were thinking about. But obviously, we've been aware of the Chinese balloon program. Taiwan has since revealed that they've been seeing a lot of balloons over Taiwan. They've flown over Japan as well. So this is something that everyone's aware of. It's not a surprise that the capability exists, but it is a surprise that they would kind of act so overtly to fly one at 60,000 feet over the whole country.
You mentioned radar stations and, you know, them potentially being more fine-tuned now to detect these balloons. A thing that many of us heard in the last couple of days is NORAD, that NORAD was the one who detected these balloons coming in and out, and along with some of the new and unidentified flying objects over U.S. airspace. Just kind of as a technical question and to explain to our listeners, what is NORAD?
Okay, so I'll caveat this with, I am not necessarily a NORTHCOM NORAD specialist, but NORAD, and it's interesting because the mission that was over Canada was also flown with NORAD supporting over Canada, authorized by the Canadian PM. But this North American kind of Air Defense Command, which is responsible for watching things that are flying over the country or off of our coasts, they track Santa every year. You know, that's the fun thing that NORAD does. But what their real job is obviously watching for airborne threats coming in over the United States and things in the stratosphere and outer atmosphere.
That makes sense. I do recall this past Christmas watching actively being tuned into their Twitter feed, trying to see if when they fly over where I live in Washington, D.C. But, you know, so far in our conversation, we've talked about what China has been doing, what we suspect China to be doing, and also, obviously, the recent incidents over the suspected Chinese spy balloon and shooting them over the coast of South Carolina. I'm wondering at this point, what's different about what we do? You know, are balloons part of U.S. intelligence gathering processes? You know, and obviously, I assume we, as in the United States, have spy satellites traveling over China. How is what China allegedly did 2 weeks ago any different from what the United States has been doing?
Well, so there's a big difference between a satellite and a balloon, and the big difference is legality, right? The use of a satellite doesn't violate sovereignty because it is in space where no one actually has sovereignty. This balloon was in American airspace, making it a violation of American sovereignty. So that's the big difference. Now, are balloons part of the U.S. intelligence gathering process? I couldn't speak to that directly, but you know, there's plenty of open source indication that this is a capability that the U.S. is interested in. They're interested in it for a number of different applications. These high altitude balloons could be used as a hasty or quickly deployed sensor network. It could provide early warning for, you know, airborne objects or things on the surface of the ocean. Anything you can hang from one of these large balloons, you could effectively build a distributed communications network from these kind of floating balloons, which in a future war, when we expect satellite capability to be degraded, it might be useful to have this deployable capability to kind of float a comms network or some sort of network back up into the sky. Now, we have used them for persistent surveillance, kind of a big eye in the sky, eye of Sauron type of a thing. We've used those on tethered balloons, which we call aerostat. That's something we've had for at least over a decade, if not 2 decades. And that's a tethered balloon. It looks more like a traditional blimp and it's on a very long leash, which effectively gives you kind of a staring eye or other type of sensor in the sky. It's not nearly as high. It's not up at 60, 70, 89, 90,000 feet, but they are useful. They had them deployed at the US-Mexico border. They've deployed them in Afghanistan. We've sold them to partners in places like the Philippines. So we've done a lot of things with the aerostat balloon, but untethered balloon technology is something that, at least in open source reporting, that's something we're still working on.
In our conversation, you've highlighted several, you know, just now as well as before, several differences between, you know, what balloons, you know, untethered balloons could do and satellites could do. You know, it's, you know, perhaps harder to be detected, has perhaps like less sophisticated technology out of fear that it might be, you know, collected by foreign governments. You know, until it was shot down, the Chinese spy balloon was the subject of frenzied public commentary for several days. You know, you have people on social media tracking the balloon with pictures, and you know, there are members of Congress who are raising, you know, fears in existential terms about what these balloons could do. From what we all know now, and obviously we can only speak about what we know now, which is, you know, we're still learning a lot more as the administration and reveals more about the capabilities and the programs. Were these frenzied public responses and, you know, for certain people, a state of panic justified?
You know, without directly criticizing anyone, you know, this quickly became a political football. You know, why isn't Biden doing more about the balloon? Why did he waste a nice missile on the balloon? Why didn't he shoot it down before? Why doesn't he shoot it down now? Oh, why did he shoot it down on my favorite part of the South Carolina beach? You know, there's something for everyone not to like, if they choose to, about how this was handled. The threat inflation piece, I think, speaks to kind of the state of the China discourse in DC at the moment. It's very convenient for both sides to be taking a very, very hard line on China, and they certainly are. And, you know, there was, for once, unified bipartisan action in the legislature condemning China for floating this balloon over the United States, which is fair, you know, good. Glad they did that. I think it's woke Washington up as well to the fact that you're dealing with a, you know, peer or near peer adversary with real capabilities. You know, the Pacific might not be the huge barrier that we once thought it was, at least to some tools that our adversary may have. But, you know, does it make sense to imply that this thing could have been carrying a nuclear weapon or a bio agent? You know, of course not. You know, that doesn't help anyone. It doesn't do any good. It feeds panic. You know, it blows this whole thing out of proportion. So it's certainly, that has certainly happened. It has been really, really, really inflated. Not to, that's a terrible pun, but I hope we just leave it in. Don't take it out in post. You know, it fed a great meme game for a week, but, you know, this will fade into the background, but I think it speaks to a very bipartisan hard line on the PRC. And that might be a wake up for Beijing as well, seeing how vociferous condemnation was of them over this episode. Something the U.S. did not lie down on, and kind of both parties were able to rally behind. So, you know, maybe this is a shot across the bow for them too.
Not to put you on the spot, but do you recall like a favorite meme or favorite, you know, balloon pun that you've seen over the last 2 weeks? I know there has been plenty of those out on Twitter and elsewhere.
Oh man. Well, I don't want to big up my own. I feel like I had a couple of strong ones at BD Herzinger, if you want to check them out. I think the best I saw was a reference to Sam Smith's outfit at the recent music awards. He wore that inflated latex suit, and it was something about, you know, an F-22 is about to chase down Sam Smith, which I thought was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, but on your point about or one of the criticisms you mentioned, you know, why do we waste a missile on this? I'm wondering, is shooting down balloons with F-22s, which, you know, the Biden administration has done with the, you know, the one off of South Carolina, as well as a couple ones detected over, you know, the other ones detected in the last week or so, is shooting them down with F-22s and missiles the most effective and perhaps cost-effective solution to this?
I would say, given that's what they did, I would say it is certainly the most effective. I would say if they had a better way to do it, they would have used it. And I would say the same for cost of effectiveness. It doesn't seem cost effective, but I doubt that they have a more effective way of doing so. This may prompt them to develop one. But you know, the initial conversation was, would an air-to-air missile even shoot this thing down? We don't know. Encounters with balloons, you know, aircraft were using their guns on them, which didn't bring it down. In World War I, you know, aircraft were trying to use guns to bring down large Zeppelins, and it was tough. And those things were, you know, giant bombs with a propeller on them. So it's not actually as easy as, you know, poking a hole in a balloon and it falls to Earth. But, you know, I'm glad they didn't use a standard missile. That would have been probably a lot more expensive. And, you know, bless the Air Force, they got to get up there and shoot some balloons down. It's been a while since they had some air-to-air action, so you gotta let them have a piece of the action sometimes, much as it pains me.
We've talked about, you know, the United States making the radars more sensitive, knowing what to pick up now, and, you know, you just mentioned perhaps the United States is looking into developing more cost-effective ways to bring down these balloons. To conclude our conversation today, how can the United States better prepare for future scenarios such as this? Are there, you know, strategies the administration should be developing, specific capabilities that we should be looking into?
My opinion on this, as opposed to, you know, a definitive physical capability, would be engaging Beijing in some extremely serious bilateral discussions on this and getting ahead of something that might happen the next time. Say, hey, look, you know, this happened once, it cannot happen again, and lay out some pretty some clear lanes in the road for making sure this doesn't happen again. I think the best solution is deconfliction and making very, very clear to Beijing that, you know, sovereignty of the United States is a red line, and, you know, consequences could be more severe in a future instance. Now, in terms of, you know, a physical solution, a cheap way would be, you know, if there is a capability that involves a directed energy weapon, you know, that's certainly cheaper. And it could maybe bring it down slower, so we'd get more pieces of it, or larger pieces at least. But, you know, we're looking at a new thing, right? So countering it won't be an overnight solution, but we do have certain tools and things in development that we might be able to apply to this in the future.
Blake, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It was such an insightful conversation.
You bet. Thank you both for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.